Today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
Now, with the Six Nations coming to an end this weekend, it got us thinking about the thrilling highs and the devastating lows of other famous sporting rivalries, whether it's two teams vying for a major title or old opponents squaring up to become the ultimate champion. The best rivalries always leave the fans coming back for more. But with the intensity and passion of those battles, so too comes the bitterness, the antagonism, and on occasion, even career-ending and life-changing consequences. And here to run through some of the greatest rivalries of all time is Gavin Cooney, sports writer with the42.ie, and Joanne O'Riordan, sports writer with the Irish Times. And you're both very welcome. Thank you for being with us today. Gavin, I'll start with you because the fans are at the heart of all this, because the rivalries between the teams or the sports stars, it's part and parcel really of how the fans identify with the sport that they know and love.
Making Iliads out of local rows, I think, is someone better spoken than me put it. But it comes like that's how often you define your identity as a sports fan. I mean, you're a Bohemians fan because you're not a Shamrock Rovers fan. You're a Celtic fan because you're not a Rangers fan, etc., etc. So rivalries are very important, obviously, in and of itself, but then obviously it comes down to defining your own team's identity as well. Mm.
And Joanne, do you agree with that? That often these rivalries are at their most intense when they're local?
Yeah, I mean, I even see it, you know, here living in Mill Street, the next club over would be Drumtariff. There's literally a bridge separating the two of them. My father's from that club. My mother's from Mill Street. So, yeah, it's like it's nonstop. You know, I remember, God, the local GA matches were just absolutely turbulent. And there was a time when, you know, I remember in Cork as well, like, you wouldn't even talk to the other person when they come in the door in the pub. You'd be like, oh, my God, John's here. I'm not going to stare at them. Like, get them out of here.
Yeah, the stress of the few days before those big local games. Listen, I want to start with one that, or two people that everybody should know and will know. The fight of the century, the thriller in Manila, Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier squaring off. They squared off three times in total. And we're going to take a listen now to the opponents during their appearance on the Dick Cavett Show. This aired in 1974 ahead of their second fight. And it begins with Muhammad Ali being asked if he's too old for a comeback.
People expect me to do good when I was young. Now I'm considered getting kind of old. So now you should, naturally, a human should start withering away. His timing should get off. He should get slow. But when you see me get into that ring with Joe Frazier, when you see me with my feet dancing faster and better than I did with Ken Norton, and when you see the punches, I'm going to be so fast, he's going to think he's surrounded. When you see what I do to... Listen, let me finish. When you see what I do to Joe Frazier, you'll realize that age means nothing in my case.
But when you see me out there this time, you'll believe that age doesn't matter in nobody's case.
I'm not saying you're old.
All right.
I'm not saying you're going to your age.
I'm going to be out there every second smoking, Jack. Every second.
You're going to be smoking, and I ain't going to be joking.
Children,
I'm going to be pecking and a poking, pouring water on your smoking.
That's what you can't.
And this might shock.
Smoke don't never die.
This might shock and amaze you, but I'm going to retire Joe Frazier. Let me tell you something, boy. Somebody told me you got. I said, Roy.
He always won the battle of words before he stepped into the ring, Muhammad Ali. But that, Gavin, that rivalry between those two, it lasted a lifetime and it was bitter.
It was bitter, and I think Frazier never really moved on from it. I think they ended up literally grappling on the floor of a television talk show that they were both on. It might even have been that show, the Dick Cavett Show. But... So, I mean, Ali said some really appalling things to Frazier, effectively to promote the fight. So Frazier became heavyweight champion of the world during Ali's exile. He refused the draft and was then stripped of his boxing license. Frazier actually agitated for Ali's license to be reinstated, like went to Richard Nixon on it, loaned him money. And you wonder, is he doing that because out of generosity to Ali, or would he really like a really high profile opponent to fight and, you know, swell his bottom line? But then things really did take a turn. Like, I mean, Ali would say he was promoting the fight by calling Frazier and Uncle Tom, you know, accusing him of betraying Black America and betraying his own people.
And that had a devastating impact on Joe Frazier and his reputation and how he was seen by Black America.
Yeah, his family got death threats, and Ali even spun his defeat in the first fight as, oh, well, this is the white man's verdict. You know, why would the white man go with Ali? They'd go with Joe Frazier. And Frazier never, I don't think Frazier ever recovered from that. Ali would say
it was an appalling thing to do. And there's a great documentary that I was just chatting to you about called The Thriller in Manila. I think it's from 2009. It's a HBO documentary. And just the seriousness of that and the impact that it had, it's just, I mean, you can't imagine what it did to Joe Frazier. And you see him close to the end of his life in his in his very late years. It defined him.
It did, ultimately, I think. There's an amazing piece as well that I found in the archives of Sports Illustrated. You'll find it just by Googling Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali, because that's what I did and came across it accidentally, where the interviewer is sitting with Joe Frazier watching the opening ceremony from the 96 Olympics with Ali lighting the flame, and, you know, his like trembling hands, to the point where Ali actually got burned when he was lighting that flame because his Parkinson's was already quite debilitating at that point. And Frazier is there saying, I hope he falls in, you know, and saying, you know, some say that I lost two fights, but maybe I won all three when you look at him, you know. So incredibly mean-spirited.
It's extraordinary. And, it's extraordinary. And Joanne, I mean, looking at that, you can see as well that that was never resolved. That rivalry was never sorted out.
No, I mean, they never managed to come together and understand that, you know, actually they technically needed each other a little bit more than what they probably cared to admit. You know, I think there was a rumour going around after the first fight that one of Muhammad Ali's agents got a phone call saying that Joe Frazier was in hospital and he was quite sick at that time. And apparently Muhammad Ali actually got down and started praying on his knees, hoping his buddy, you know, would come back at some stage. But I mean, it just really shows. And then on the flip side, then Muhammad Ali came out saying he was only in hospital for 10 minutes after the first bout, and he actually wasn't in hospital because Joe Frazier put him in there. And he wanted to stress that Joe Frazier never put him in there. He only went for a standard checkup. So yeah, I mean, they absolutely hate each other, you know, and I think as Gavin alluded to, it just went down to the fact that they were throwing constant, you know, slurs at each other. You know, Joe Frazier refused to reference Muhammad Ali. He would only say Cassius Clay, which Muhammad Ali would say is a slave name. And it was just constant back and forth. And I suppose, you know, we'll see with other rivalries, they actually never got together even in life and even in death as well. They just continue to hate each other.
Yeah, it's just a real tragedy that, you know, it lasted for as long as it did. Now, our next pair, tennis champions Martina Navratilova and Chris Evert, they're interesting because there was a rivalry here, but it wasn't marked by the kind of enmity that we've just been talking about. They were really supportive of each other. Nowadays, both of them have said that without each other as rivals, they wouldn't have been as successful in their playing careers. Let's take a listen to Chris Evert explain.
First of all, definition of a great rivalry for me, what makes it really interesting and intriguing is one word, contrast. If you have two players that are playing the same way and have the same personalities and have the same set of fans, it's not going to be as interesting. But I think with my experience having that rivalry with Martina, it was all about the differences, the contrast in style and personality, in everything. And we brought our own set of fans to the table. And the other great thing about a rivalry is it makes you a better player. It builds your game. You lose a few matches. You go back to the drawing board. How can I beat this one person? And you find a way. You find a way, whether it's training or whether psychological, to get the edge.
Great insight there. How do I beat this one person? Can you imagine being so obsessed? But Joanne, she's explaining there that there are different styles of tennis. That's what made it interesting to watch.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, on the court, you had the big physical presence, you know, of Martina. You had the kind of lovely all-American girl next door, but still a powerhouse with her in her own right, you know, and Chrissy Evert. And yeah, I think it was just incredibly interesting to see the two of them. You know, I remember Chrissy actually saying that when Martina started beating her, she didn't actually start to like her as much anymore. She started to kind of be like, I don't think I like her as much, which is incredibly interesting. But then when the two of them, you know, fell on, you know, hard times, you know, respectively with Martina, her identity of, you know, being from the Soviet Union, being in America, coming out with her sexuality. And then Chrissy, you know, Chrissy always says, you know, she actually wasn't the nicest girl, you know, that you'd ever meet. But the two of them are best friends and they both fell on each other, you know, during hard times. And I think really it was only until, you know, Martina started kind of hitting the gym and, you know, properly owning the fact that, you know, she's got a very powerful shot. She actually was like, hang on, this might be the way for me to beat Chrissy. And then they obviously would have teamed up for doubles, you know, because they were friendly. And then eventually they were looking at each other going, actually, I think she knows my game a little bit more. And Chrissy actually called a halt to the doubles. She was like, no, Martina's seeing everything I'm doing. So it was incredibly interesting to see. And I think they have a lovely... they have a lovely documentary on ESPN. It's called Unmatched. And it's basically the two of them sitting down on a couch, walking a beach together. And they're just chatting about their history, about their friendship, about their rivalry. And yeah, fair enough, it's a little bit, you know, kind of lovely and cheesy. But they really are. You can see they're best friends underneath it all.
So now we know, Gavin, that you don't have to have that bitterness that we were just talking about with the other two. to have the rivalry.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Which is the interesting thing, that there was never that enmity bred by the competitiveness together, and the fact that they won the French Open together. But the media did portray them as quite different characters, to the point where I thought maybe Navratilova might object to how she was portrayed. But it was actually Everett kind of was a bit fed up with this kind of cleaner than Wimbledon whites character that was put across. She gave an interview to Sports Illustrated to say, look, I'm not as goody two-shoes as people think. And then to find...
Stop saying I'm nice.
All these terrible things that she did. She says, I'm a normal woman. I've dated a lot of guys. I've had a few drinks. I've told dirty jokes. I've cursed. I've been rude to my parents. There's nothing in my life and no skeletons in my closet that people should be so shocked about. So, yeah, real tearaway stuff there from...
Let's move on to motor racing now. Ayrton Senna, Alain Prost, two of the greatest Formula One drivers of all time. Now, their rivalry was arguably at its most acute when they were teammates. And we're going to hear a clip now from 1990. Senna was needled by the legendary Scottish Formula One champion, Jackie Stewart. He suggested that Senna was intentionally putting other drivers in danger in order to win.
By being a racing driver, you are under risk all the time. And if you no longer go for a gap that exists, you're no longer a racing driver. Because we are competing. We are competing to win. And the main motivation to all of us is to compete for a victory. You either commit yourself as a professional racing driver that is designed to win races, or you come second, or you come third, or you come fifth. And I'm not designed to come third, fourth, or fifth. I race to win as long as I feel is possible. Sometimes you get it wrong, sure. It's impossible to get it right all the time. But I race designed to win, and as long as I feel I'm doing it right. Some people agree, some don't. In the end, I'm the one who is doing. I'm the one who is driving. And I can only do what speaks for my mind.
So what was the deal here, Gavin? They were just trying to run each other off the track.
Effectively. I think Senna would run anyone off the track. He didn't really discriminate, but the person ahead of him was obviously most often in danger, and that happened to be Alain Prost. Like Senna, there had never been a racing driver really like that before, that was so devil-may-care. And, okay, the use of the word devil is a bit ironic because he was extremely religious. He talked about literally seeing the face of God as he crossed the checkered flag to win his first championship. And Senna raced, and he talked about this being as if his purpose on earth, he was put on earth by God to win motor races. So if you can you imagine a guy coming
what
up
a
behind,
mission
coming in, but can you imagine someone coming up in your rear view mirror and saying, well, God has put me on this track to overtake you. And Martin Brundle is a commentator now, and he talked about what it was like to race Senna. He said you'd see the green helmet hover in your rear view mirror, and you had two options. You can get out of his way and avoid a crash, or you can stay where you are and you can have a crash. Mm-hmm. Prost wasn't one too often pulled to the side and allowed Senna overtake him. So they crashed in 1989 in this, I think it was the penultimate race of the season. That ended in Prost winning the championship. A year later, same track, final race of the championship. Senna was ahead. If neither finished, then Senna would win the championship. Senna attacked on turn one and took them both out. And Prost at that point, Prost came off that track threatening to retire, called Senna a disgusting man, a man of no value. But they did seem to reconcile in their latter years. I think they reconciled when Prost retired and stopped being a threat to Senna in terms of winning championships. He hauled him to the top of the podium on his final race in 1993. And there's actually a huge poignancy to it, because in 1994, it was at Imola in San Marino that Senna was killed in that crash on the Sunday. And he did a practice lap that morning. There was a radio link up with a French television station, and he called out and said, oh, we miss hello to our dear friend Alain Prost. We miss you, Alain. Mm-hmm. That was the day he died. He died hours later. And I don't know if you've seen the amazing documentary film about Senna by Asif Kapadia that Prost contributes to. He's one of the main talking
heads. I think it's on Netflix, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I've seen it. And Prost was quite upset that they didn't make more explicit the fact that they had reconciled, you know, that they didn't play that footage. Mm-hmm. I think he called the documentary fake, which I think it's a little bit harsh on Prost. Like, you could see that they did reconcile from, you know, like this footage of him, Prost blessing himself at Senna's coffin and things like that.
Okay, well, I'm going to move on because I don't want to miss out on this next one, the quintessential figure skating rivalry, Tonya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan. And listeners will remember that the rivalry spilled over into crime and whodunit because Harding's ex-husband and her bodyguard hired a man to try and break Kerrigan's leg. That attack left her with a bad bruise. She went on to win a silver Olympic medal in 1996 1994. Harding was later stripped of her US title, banned for life from figure skating. We'll take a listen to a snippet from an interview that Tonya Harding did with Oprah in 2009.
If Nancy Kerrigan were here today, what would you want to say to her about all of this?
Well, if she'd let me, I'd love to give her a hug and just, you know, tell her how proud I am of her being able to go forward with her life and everything and stuff like that. And congratulations on her children. And I mean, she's moved on. I've moved on. It's part of history that will always be with us. Mm-hmm. But I'm also noted as the one and only American woman that did the first triple axel. And those are the things that no one can take away from me.
Oh, Joanne, that's brilliant. I wish her well, but I'm still the best.
Yeah, I mean, if that doesn't sum up Tonya Harding, I'm not too sure whatever will. But look, I mean, Tonya really is still the only one talking about it to this day. You know, Nancy's taken the fine line. She's put out the odd statement whenever things are getting a little bit too heated. And she just says, I want to move on. I've done everything that I possibly can. Can this woman please, please possibly move on with her life too? And it's just, it, you know what, it's incredible to see. You know, I think it literally was the price of gold, you know, for Tonya, for her ex-husband, the bodyguard, and the person who was allegedly hired, you know, to take out Nancy essentially. But yeah, look, I mean, this was everything you wanted. This was Nancy Kerrigan, was the girl next door once again in America. Tonya was the threat. You know, she wasn't a judge's favorite. She was a bit erratic. Chaos was essentially her definition. And I think it just essentially was boiled down to, you know, Tonya was just incredibly frustrated with the fact she wanted to be the best. She was probably, you know, in her eyes, the best, but Nancy was still the one favored every single time over and over and over again. And it ate away at her eventually. It ate away at her. But now she's managed to change the narrative. And I think a lot of figure skating fans are a little bit dubious of it because she's changed the narrative into the fact that I, Tonya, I'm actually the victim at the end of the day.
And that's the movie. And if people haven't seen it as well, worth a watch. It's called I, Tonya, as I say. Joanne, thanks so much. Joanne O'Riordan, sports writer with the Irish Times. Gavin Cooney with the 42.ie. A quick break.